Well, welcome everyone. This is a theme I come to every fall, and I usually give this talk on Labor Day, but the dates didn't quite work out. But it's something I give in September because September is kind of a new beginning every year at the Zen Center. During the summer, people are gone. We have fewer classes. In the fall, we have more classes, and things begin to really quicken. And if you look on the board, you'll see there are lots of classes and lots of things going on. Yesterday morning, we had a half-day session that some of us were at. And so this is my a talk I call Taking Stock. It's a good time at the beginning of the, kind of our new year here to actually think about our practice and where we are. And it's easy to fall into the pattern of just kind of coming, once or twice, even fewer times, etc. Maybe reading a Zen book or two. And the question is, well, how does that deepen your practice? And do you really think about the concepts and practices that you're pursuing? And so this is more of a let's think about these things kind of talk rather than giving you any real advice. So I'd like to do two things this morning. First, I'd like to review some of the real basic foundations of Buddhism. In fact, the Buddha's first talk and ask us, how do we understand what he said? And then second, I'd like to explore what a contemporary understanding of this practice might be. And that's more my understanding than necessarily other people's understanding, etc. So first, what are the most basic foundations of Buddhism? And I take that to be really the lessons that the Buddha delivered in his very first talk. And if you remember the Buddha's enlightenment story, and some of you do and some of you don't, but remember that the Buddha was, according to legend, a pampered prince until he saw four signs. And he saw a sick person, an old person, be careful here, a dead person, and he also saw a seeker or a mendicant. That is a person trying to find the way. And his parents had tried to shield him, if you will, from the so-called sorrows of the world. So the Buddha set out on a journey for 5 years in which he tried to... he tried all kinds of, particularly ascetic kinds of practices, etc., to find the reason and answer to the suffering in the world. And then, without going into more detail, he sat down under the Bodhi tree, a particular kind of fig tree, and he had his great enlightenment. And that's the Dharma, basically, that we have today. And he went through three watches. And just to give a little background, that is three parts of the night. And the first part, he actually reviewed his past lives. And today we might see our past actions in our life, if you will. And the second watch, in the middle of the night, he actually looked for pattern or saw pattern in his past life. And in our lives, we know if we do something bad, chances are we're going to get our just reward, etc., whatever. And then the third watch, he actually understood the underlying principles behind that pattern. And then after his enlightenment, this occurred at Bodh Gaya, and he went to find the other ascetics that he had practiced with, etc., and he gave his first talk, and this was at Varanasi. And you don't have to remember any of the names, but this is, whether it's true or not, it's kind of our foundational story, and it's an important one. Kind of the core of his first talk was the Four Noble Truths, and I want to basically talk about that and our understanding of that, and then along the way we'll look at some other things as well. And his Four Noble Truths were really the problem of suffering, his answer to the problem of suffering, and it really follows an old Indian a problem-solving pattern. And the first that has four parts. And the first question is, what is the problem? And then the second part, what is the root of the problem? The third part, is there a solution? If so, what is it? And then the fourth part, what is the path to the solution? So again, the Four Noble Truths are really just based upon this traditional Indian problem-solving approach. The first noble truth, what is the problem, is that all life is suffering, and that's the traditional word. I like the Indian word dukkha, that we perhaps shouldn't try to translate it, but it means all kinds of things. It means a certain uncomfortableness with life. When I hear the word dukkha, I always think of Emerson's famous phrase, all people live a life of quiet desperation, whether that's true or not. But also, underlying this dissatisfaction, etc., is the idea that of impermanence, that all things are impermanent, which leads to this feeling of suffering. Youth, wealth, a stable relationship, things like this come and may go. And so this leads to suffering, if you will. The second noble truth was the cause of suffering. What is the cause? And the cause was what they call desire, etc. And that we think of desire, it has a number of different translations or words, sometimes delusion, things like this. But anyway, it's what happens when one attaches to things that are non-permanent. And when things they are permanent. But there are a lot of reasons for this problems with attachment, etc. One has to do basically with our understanding of the world. And most of us don't think much about the world, and we just assume that our ideas about the world basically are the way the world is. If you read, I was reading Graham Greene's book, The Fabric of the Universe, and he's a physicist, and I figured he was going to tell me all about atoms and things, but he says, the reality we observe, matter evolving on the stage of space and time, may have little to do with the reality, if any, that's out there. And if you read modern physics, you understand that what we see and what we construct is far different from what physicists see. The way I like to think of it, I'm an anthropologist, and the way I like to think of it is that we have certain species specific sense organs. The way we see, the way we understand, even in Buddhism, your mind and consciousness is an organ. The way we hear, etc., all fall within certain ranges. And a good example would be sight. What happens when light rays hit something and radiates back onto our eyes? And we only see within a certain length of the electromagnetic spectrum. If we were bats or flies or dogs or whatever, we would see really quite different. Not every animal, and most don't, see in three dimensions, for example. Most animals don't see in color. So when your dog looks at you, they'll see that really neat blue shirt you have on. They don't see in color, and they don't see in three dimensions, etc. And the point is, and the same thing with hearing. And if you understand something about the structure of the brain of animals of different kinds, you'll see that their structure really differs depending upon the importance of individual senses. So a dog, if you actually look at the brain, will have a lot of those kind of sensory apparatus, and they have this big snout with a sensory epithelium. But this to me is pretty important, because what it means is that we basically reconstruct the world, through these sense impressions, etc. And so this causes the problem, if you will, that the world we see is constructed basically by our mind, which is an important Buddhist principle. And related to this, these kind of constructed ideas are what we call, and this is just, we're starting to get into, what do you think about these things? taking stock of your own beliefs, we see what we call the three poisons in Buddhism. And these are greed, if you will. You want something. They're hatred or aversion, if you will. And then the third one has different definitions, but oftentimes ignorance, that is ignorance of the way things are, you know, the way things come and the way we see them. Sometimes it just means indifference, if you will. And so one thing we want to think about, you know, in our own Buddhist practice is, you know, what does something like a greed or want or attraction really mean? You know, and then how does it really shape what we do? And these are things to really sit on or sit with on your cushion. You know, what things attract us? What things do we not want, et cetera? You know, where are our areas of ignorance, if you will? And again, you may think of these ideas about cosmology is what we call them. You know, these ideas about how the world is constructed, et cetera, is not Buddhist, but it's something the Dalai Lama in the last 15 years has been very, very much interested in and works with something called the Mind and Life Institute and has about five or six different books out trying to understand, you know, how the understanding of the modern cosmos influences Buddhism. And it reminds me of a story that Ken MacLeod told me one time. He was a Buddhist teacher in Los Angeles. And he was a translator for Tibetan monks. And he took one famous monk, you know, way up into, you know, northern Alaska, where in the summertime, night doesn't come. It's light all the time. So after the first evening, first night when nothing got dark and everything was light, you know, the monk said, Ken, something's wrong. Come on in. Find a place to sit. And, you know, Ken took an apple and an orange and tried to explain, you know, how the sun goes around the earth and the earth changes, etc. The monk went into a funk, if I can put it that way, for 2 months because obviously his cosmology, etc., wasn't being supported, etc. So anyway, this is something that we have to really look at. So those, again, when you take stock, you know, we take stock, basically, you know, something like the three poisons. And this is important. These are things we actually can sit with. You know, you can think about, just go through and just watch yourself. And one way to do this in meditation is what we call marking sometimes. And that is you sit there, and if you learn just to sit back and observe your thoughts as they come up, and they're just thoughts, and you're kind of the observer, if you will, and you just look at the nature of what those thoughts are, and you usually put them in four or five categories, if you will. And one of mine is always planning. You know, I always seem to be busy, and so I'm always planning for things, etc. But it may be desire, it may be dislike, etc. And so just kind of watch those thoughts, if you will. Well, the third noble, well, part of this, before I go on, etc., also is the understanding of the nature of the self, and this gets a little more obtuse for people, particularly if you're new to Buddhism and somebody says you know, that there is no ego self, and then you look around the room and everybody's looking at you, and you know, you're sitting here and you get tax bills, etc., and you know, you drive your car home and things like that, but it helps to understand you know, what they mean. And in Buddhism, we refer to the you know, what is the self, basically is the five aggregates or the five skandhas, etc. And I wanted to say something very briefly about them, because this is another aspect of Buddhism we sit with. You know, we kind of sit with it and try to understand it. And the first is form. And what they mean by form is just you and your senses, but also everything out there. And so I think of a green tree, for example, that a tree that reflects green. It's green to me because of the way I see the electromagnetic spectrum, etc. And so that's part of form. What's out there. And so it's not just the object itself, but basically it's the way things are reflected at you and, you know, your various sensory abilities, etc. And then the second of the aggregates are feelings, or at least the initial contact. So without going into any detail, you know, those light rays hit the iris. And it's fascinating, by the way, to actually look at all of this. It hits the iris, etc. There are little electrical stimuli, and you think you're seeing the world the way it is, right? And it goes up, etc. And in your mind, etc., it turns into these three-dimensional colored things, if you will. And so that's feeling and perception. Basically, the third is really recognizing what that is, in a sense, green. Or let's say something like hornet. Hornet, you know, something that's a little more threatening. Hornet. And then the fourth basically is some kind of a mental formation or the beginning of a reaction is a way to think about that. Avoidance or whatever. And then the fifth is consciousness or awareness of this. And basically I mention all of this because what you can do in meditation is actually work with those aggregates and look at reactions, etc., and kind of work your way back to see particularly where the three poisons actually come out. Well, oftentimes we think that our reactions and the way we see things or hear things or think about things are kind of natural when a lot of this is actually learned. And so what about... and so the Buddha, this is a story the Buddha always talked about, the five aggregates. And if you go through form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, you know, there's nothing left. There's no self. There's no ego, if you will. And the very core of Buddhism is something we want to think about, basically, is that it's this idea of an ego, etc., that leads to these three poisons. And so here's a little story. That a teaching story to help us grasp this idea of non-self. The Buddha teaches that the self doesn't exist except as an ever-shifting combination of five aggregates. The monk Nagasena used the analogy of a chariot to explain this doctrine to King Milinda. Then there's a whole series of stories, interchanges between the monk and the king, who ruled northwestern India. In the first century BCE and is said to have converted to Buddhism. The analogy is one of many recorded in an oft-quoted Theravada text, The Questions of Milinda. Nagasena said to Milinda, regarding the chariot, and this is called the analogy of the chariot, you said you wrote here, what is a chariot? Is it the pole? No, replied Milinda. Or the axle, wheels, frame, reins, yoke, or spoke? Spokes? No, replied Milinda. Is it then all of these separate parts that is the chariot? No, replied Milinda. Is a chariot something outside these separate parts then? No, replied Milinda. Then I can find no chariot. A chariot is just a practical designation, said Milinda. It refers to when all the parts are present and assembled and functioning. It's the same with the self, responded Nagasena. It refers to when all the aggregates are present and assembled and functioning. It's just a practical designation. And so, again, it's a good story to keep in mind. Okay. And then the third noble truth is that suffering can be ended. There is a way. It's possible to lessen our discontent. The fourth is the way to suffering is the noble eightfold path. On the third noble truth, when it says, you know, there is a way, to at least lessen suffering. I always like to make a distinction between suffering and pain, or maybe pain and suffering. And pain, something happens to your leg or your arm, and it hurts. Okay, that's pain. Suffering is when you say, "Oh me," you know, "Oh me," you know, "Poor me," you know, and you make things worse, etc. And you're always basically going to have problems in life. You can be a Buddha, a good Buddha. You can practice all the time, and it doesn't mean you have problems. So when we say basically that suffering can be ended, it doesn't mean problems are ended. What's ended basically is our perception of the problems that we have. And here's another little story, again, another teaching story. If I can find it. And this is called the ultimate problem. In the famous exchange with a farmer, the Buddha showed the persistence and pernicious nature of desire, the cause of all suffering. The farmer said to him, "I like to farm, but there are lots of problems. Sometimes it rains too much and my crops get flooded out. Sometimes it rains too little and they dry up." The Buddha listened attentively until the farmer finished and changed the subject. "I love my wife," he said, "but she's far from perfect. Sometimes she's cold to me for no reason at all. Sometimes she's so passionate that she wears me out." Again, the Buddha listened patiently until the farmer once more changed the subject. "My children are wonderful," he said, "but they're always giving me trouble. Sometimes they fight with each other and break things. Sometimes they conspire against me." And so it went for quite a while, the Buddha listening quietly and the man continuing to complain. Finally, the farmer finished speaking and the Buddha said, "There's nothing I can do to help you, farmer. We've all got 83 problems and that's that. Maybe you can take care of one, but nothing one is bound to take... but another one is bound to take its place. And some never change. For example, your farm, your wife, your children, even yourself, all will eventually pass away and there's nothing you can do about it." The farmer, outraged, said, "You're supposed to be a great teacher. What good is that teaching?" The Buddha replied, "It may help you with the 84th problem." "What on earth is the 84th problem?" said the farmer. The Buddha answered, "You ought not to have any problems." Okay, the way to end suffering, then, is the Noble Eightfold Path. And so let's look briefly again at the Eightfold Path. I like to think of them as the three trainings, and we put them kind of into three bundles. And I like to call them the three trainings, etc., because they actually are something to work on. The three bundles, if you will, are the wisdom or discernment bundle, the morality or virtue bundle, and the mental discipline or the concentration bundle. And again, we want to think about these in the depth of our understanding. In Buddhism, when we use the word wisdom, when I think of the word wisdom, I often, you think of that Merlin or somebody like that with they can do all kinds of magical things and whatever. But in Buddhism, wisdom really refers to a deep and clear understanding of the Buddha's basic teachings or the Dharma. And so that's what we mean by wisdom here. And this particular wisdom bundle is formed of two of these parts of the Eightfold Path. And the first is called a right view. And a right view really is just, it's a deep understanding of the Buddhist teaching, but also a deep understanding of reality. And I like to, a lot of times people just think, well, right view, and I like, again, just to read a little bit about correct views, etc. And this is from a book called Mind at Ease by Traleg Rinpoche, etc. And he starts off by pointing out that correct views are just as important as correct meditation. And he says, "Buddhist meditation practices and experiences are always discussed from a particular viewpoint that is always taken to be valid and true. This cannot be otherwise. Correct views have the ability to lead us to liberation, while incorrect views increase the delusions of our mind. That is why we need a proper orientation or correct view when we embark on the path. Correct view is, in fact, our spiritual vehicle, the transport we use to journey from the bondage of samsara to the liberation of nirvana. Conversely, incorrect views have the potential to lead us off course, and like a poorly constructed raft which casts us adrift and deposits on the shores of misery, there is no separation between the vehicle that transports us to our spiritual destination and the views that we hold in our mind." And I want to give another little quote by Traleg Rinpoche. And what attracted me to Zen, when I look back, was all the wrong reasons. I became an archaeologist, and what attracted me to archaeology, again, was all the wrong reasons. I read a wonderful, delightful book called God's Grays and Scholars by C.W. Ceram that came out in about 1956 when I was still in high school. And he talks about, this is the great romance of archaeology. He talks about archaeologists opening the Egyptian tombs and could hear the mummies crack under his footsteps, things like this. The gold of Troy. Well, of course, that's not what archaeology is about. When I started to read about Buddhism, what did I read first but the Dharma bumps? Remember Jacques Curiac? I don't know if anyone still reads all of these things, etc. But the idea was that, there are no views. And in fact, don't tell me what to do. It was the idea that Buddhism and right view is really to learn to have no view, if you will. And so here's what Trollope had to say. Buddhism states that our normal views inhibit us and chain us to the limited condition of samsara, where the correct view can lead us to our ultimate spiritual destination. We should not conclude from this, although modern Western Buddhists often do, that meditation is all about getting rid of views, or that all views will hinder us from attaining our spiritual goal. This assumption is based on the legitimate premise that Buddhist teachings emphatically identify the need to develop a non-conceptual wisdom mind in order to attain liberation and enlightenment. However, many people mistakenly think that this implies that we do not need to believe in anything. Nobody tells me what to do, that is, and that all forms of conceptuality must be dispensed with right from the beginning. It is only incorrect views that we need to overcome. The correct and noble views to be cultivated with great diligence. And I just point that out. And so we're talking about taking stock. And again, we look inside ourselves in our teaching to take stock. What is our concept of right view? What is our concept of reality? What is our concept of the Buddhist basic teaching? And so this is really kind of the foundation, if you will, of the Eightfold Noble Path, if you will. Okay, the second part of this wisdom training of the three trainings has a lot of names, but it's right thought sometimes, right thinking. This is what Thich Nhat Hanh refers to it as. Sometimes it's right cognition or right resolve. And what it means basically is thinking to see things as they are, but more usefully for me, it's having a clear, healthy intention behind what our actions are. And so we do no harm to ourselves, and we do no harm to others. And so again, we think of this as right thinking or right cognition, if you do. Okay, the second package, and there are three parts of this in the old Eightfold Path, is our morality or virtual path. And oftentimes when people start to practice Buddhism, this is the place to start because it's perhaps the easiest, to do. And this refers to right speech, right action, right livelihood. And again, in all of these, we have to think deeply about what we mean by these kinds of thoughts. For example, right speech really means nonviolent communication. It doesn't mean, for example, just don't lie, but it means to talk supportively, if you will. And right action means, abstaining from actions like stealing or sexual misconduct, if you will, but also do no harm, do good. Finally, right livelihood refers to abstaining from occupations that cause harm to yourself or to others. And then the last of three trainings in the last three parts of the Eightfold Path refer to mental discipline, if you will, sometimes called concentration or mindfulness. And again, all of these parts of the path, we want to really think about deeply, and these are things to sit basically on our cushion and just see what arises in our mind when we think about things like right action, right livelihood, right view, right thinking, etc. And the first of the mental discipline is really right effort. And this is always a good one in Buddhism because it doesn't mean necessarily going to the Buddha hall every morning and sitting like this, for 2 hours. You sit the straightest. Everybody knows if you've been around a lot of meditation, there's always somebody who's just the straightest and sits the longest and things like this. Is not what right effort basically means. But right effort means that to practice according to what the situation basically calls for, if you will. What's best for the moment, if you will. Be persistent in your practice, whatever that means. And it may not necessarily be just sitting there forever. Right mindfulness refers to learning to be single-pointed. Be present in the moment. And then finally, right concentration has a number of meanings, but basically can refer to various forms of consciousness. And let me just look at this. And in Buddhism, in concentration, etc., there are four levels. Sometimes there are eight levels. And this is something we tend not to talk about here. If I'll point some readings out later, but if you actually read one of these great Philip Capwell's book, The Three Pillars of Zen, they talk about in your meditation actually working through these three forms of awareness, if you will. And let me see if I can see what I did with it. Okay, these are just the four classic phases of consciousness. The first is called letting go of desires. And the second, the attaining of peace, a peaceful inner calm. The refining of the still cognitive framework into one of a pure awareness and well-being. And finally, the achieving of a state of simple wakefulness and equanimity. And I didn't do well in reading those things. But basically the idea is that in your practice that there are these phases of awareness that we work to attain. Well, all of this is kind of leads in a spiraling circle back to right view. And when we think of the Noble Eightfold Path, etc., we tend to think of these three trainings, but they're all kind of interconnected. But the idea in one picture is this kind of spiraling, upward spiral, where right view leads to a deeper understanding, basically, of morality. And this leads to a deeper practice in mental training. All of this is part of what we call the tacit assumptions of Buddhism. And I just wanted to mention a couple. And in the very first chapter, it was a famous book by Edward Kanza called Buddhist Thought in India. And he's always one of our favorite guys because he's one of the great grouches in Buddhist writings, and his eyes complaining and things like that. And so it's kind of a fun read, Buddhist Thought in India. But it refers to that one of the classic Asian ways of understanding reality is various phases of awareness. And this is an important part of their worldview, which is kind of different than our worldview. And so there are shallower and deeper understandings. And this leads to the idea that the Buddhist words, and this is true in most religions, are what they call noumenous concepts. And what they mean by that is the meaning or definition of the concept changes as your awareness deepens. And this introduces all kinds of interesting problems in Buddhism, because you can go to the bookstore, you can get a great book, and I have some here. It's like you can read it, but you can only read it in understanding from your level of understanding. Okay, and in most of these cases, they're written from this very advanced level of understanding. And so it helps when you read these things to be aware, of these differences, etc., and that one's going to works one's way through this, if you will. Also, when we talk about oftentimes when you read the Eightfold Path, we'll use the word right, like right action or right mindfulness, and we want to be a little clearer in our sitting basically what right means. And what it basically means is appropriate thought, appropriate action, if you will. And so I'm kind of winding down here a little bit, but this leads to some thought about the basic vows that one takes when one becomes a Buddhist. I used to be a Catholic, maybe I still am, I don't know. You go through confirmation where you take all these vows, and we have something like that in Buddhism. And in fact, if you look around and you see these little bib-like things, Ben has one on, etc. You know, this is just signals that somebody is actually going through chukai, a word we don't use in this center, but it's just the initiation into Buddhism. And in the process of doing that, you take 16 vows, and I'm not going to go through them all. Let me see where I am on all of this. But I wanted to mention some. Because this is, really helps us understand a little bit of our practice, if you will. There's something called the five basic or general precepts. And then there's six more I want to really mention in passing. And one is avoid causing harm to other sentient beings. In general, it means to refrain from life-damaging violence of all kinds, whether it's in one's thoughts, words, or deeds. More specifically, it asks one not to take another person's life or even one's own. And oftentimes, and when you take the precept, it just says something like, don't kill, something like that. But it's deeper than all of that. A second, avoid taking anything that is not freely given. Usually it says, do not steal. But it also could be generous. Be generous. It also bids one to refrain from manipulating or exploiting people or from making unreasonable demands on them. Its general purpose is to encourage the practitioner to let go of possessiveness, craving, and attachment. A third is avoid sexual misconduct. In this spirit, Buddhism counsels people to refrain from abusive or manipulated sex, as well as from sexual obsession, jealousy, or deception. A fourth is avoid untruthfulness. It encourages people to be straightforward in all aspects of their life so that they don't mislead others as well as themselves in any way that might be harmful. And a fifth is avoid clouding the mind with drugs. Maintain and promote clear mindfulness at all times. And so we want to think a little bit, and again, if you're interested and you have a practice, it's good to come back in your sitting and think about what these basic precepts mean. The other six, and I wanted to put them in two packages. Three are taking refuge. You take refuge in the Buddha. You take refuge in the Dharma. You take refuge in the Sangha. So what's that mean to you? What's it really mean? It's easy just to repeat these things as words, but what does it mean to sit? And thinking about being in refuge with the Sangha. And then the last three basically are, the first is do no harm. And what's it mean? I always like that because it doesn't say do good. It starts by saying do no harm. And then if you can handle that, then you worry about do no good. And then the third basically is the Bodhisattva vow, and that is the vow to the helper free all beings. So again, these are the kinds of things that we basically want to sit with. Now, if we pull our understandings, and if we look at Buddhism, and if you look at Zen across the country, you'll see that it's really quite diverse. And so when we think of our own practice, we want to think of what kind of practice basically is it? Because there are many ways to practice. And there's no pope in charge of a Soto Zen. We're a Soto center, etc. And so you find a lot of variety and difference in Zen centers. In just two books, real quickly, if you look at the three pillars of Zen, which again is about Soto Zen, there's all kinds of koans and things like this and all kinds of different practices. A more recent version is John Dietl Laurie's book called The Eight Gates of Zen, a program of Zen training. And this is at Mount Tremper, for example. And again, there are koans, there are body trainings, there are art trainings, and on and on. And so there are all kinds of different Zen. trainings, and so you want to look in yourself, etc., and to see what your training's like. The way of ritual, the way of body movement, the way of compassion and caring, the way of devotionalism, and other ways. My way, and I just wanted to mention quickly, is a way of diversity, and the idea that diversity is to be expected and embraced in this early phase of the incorporation of Buddhism, or more specifically Zen, into the Western world. And this is what I call big raft Zen. And the idea that in Zen centers, you know, there are all kinds of people with different practices, etc. And we want to open our doors, basically, to that diversity. Again, as part of our bodhisattva vow, you know, to free all beings if you can. We don't have a monastery system. There are some monasteries, but we don't have a monastery system in Western Buddhism. But we do have centers like this. And again, a center like this should embrace diversity. If you will. So again, think about our basic views. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them or save them, whichever. And again, what's your understanding of that when you take stock, if you will? You know, what does freeing people mean? Desires or delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to extinguish them. And then what's that mean? You know, what is a desire or a delusion? And when you sit on your mat, what's it mean, basically, to extinguish them? What's it mean? And it's just too easy, basically, in our practice to mouth these things. And we sit there in the morning and we say these things. And, you know, here in the morning we have a meditation practice, etc. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. This is all part of the bodhisattva vow, if you will. Okay, so these are just some really brief, you know, kind of ideas about taking stock. And so the question is, I started by saying, well, how can we basically take stock? It's a kind of a new beginning. You know, where do we go? You know, I just mentioned a few books, and then I want, you know, people to maybe recommend others or other kind of practices. And then we'll talk about some other things. For example, I mentioned Philip Capel's book. It's a little dated, but it's still a very inspirational kind of book, even though it first came out in the 1960s. I mentioned John Dietl Laurie's book, The Eight Gates of Zen, which is a very recent book and a very, a good introduction to what some of the contemporary practices are in Western Zen. Part of the problem we have in particularly Soto Zen is that the first Soto Zen teachers were Japanese monks who actually came to San Francisco and other areas. And they were working with quite different people. And so the simplest thing was to say, just sit. Just sit. And as John Dietl Laurie points out in this book, etc., a lot of the subtlety of the teaching and the real depth of teaching that you might get in Japan, therefore, were kind of downplayed, etc., just because of the difficulty of this kind of communication. So this is an excellent book. A book I like, and I'm teaching a course, I think starting next month, just called The Heart of Zen Teaching. And this is The Heart of the Buddhist Teaching by Thich Nhat Hanh. And again, it's a great introduction to really basic concepts and some of the concepts I've been talking about today. And again, think of right view, right view, right view, right view, etc., you know, to really get those ideas in. When I talk about a big raft Zen, and this can be a problem because some centers can be so narrow, etc., that they want to exclude people with different views. You know, it's not Soto Zen, for example. It's not proper practice, etc. One of the best books, I think, for Big Raft is One Dharma by Joseph Goldman, etc., you know, who argues for what I call Big Raft Zen. And then if you're looking for something that's more practical, and I haven't mentioned lots of things like meditation, enlightenment, you know, all kinds of things. There's this nice little book by Christina Feldman called Beginner's Guide to Buddhist Meditation. We teach a course here at least once a year called Meditation for Beginners, and this is one of the books we use. There are a lot of varieties, basically, of meditating. Finally, I just wanted to say just a little bit about, we have various courses, Dan's going to mention some of them perhaps in passing. They're also up on the board out there. Practice period's beginning to start. We have particularly important, in my view, is we have retreats, or what are called sessions, which are basically concentrated practice periods. We had a half-day practice period yesterday morning that was led by Rosemary Taylor over here. We have a long weekend coming up in two weekends at Hokioji, the country center. We have Rohatsu, which is a week-long retreat coming up at the end of the year. And again, it's sitting down with these kinds of ideas that are really important. And then, last but not least, we have meetings with teachers, particularly you can meet with our head teacher, Tim Burkett, who happens to be in the Caribbean at the present time. But we also have meetings with other teachers, such as Rosemary and myself. And I think that the only ones who are here, etc. So that's it for me, and I just wanted to open it to anyone who wanted to add something about, again, taking stock, something that you've read, maybe some courses you've taken, anything like that. Yeah, an updated one for sure. Just a little bit about readings, and you can go in the present moment, the old Orr bookstore, which is long gone. You can get on Amazon.com, and you can look at just put Buddhist books, and you're going to find all kinds of books. And of course, a little bit, one of the reasons we want to learn something about the history of Zen, remember Zen starts, not Zen, but excuse me, Buddhism starts in India. Perhaps about 500 BCE, and it spreads southwards through Sri Lanka, into Thailand. It goes across the Silk Route into China, eventually the Korea and Vietnam and Japan. And all of these areas, it really takes on, much of the flavor of the local culture. And Zen kind of comes out of amalgam, basically, of Taoism and Buddhism in China. And so you read all these books, and they all come from these different areas, and it can be very confusing because they have all kinds of different ideas we're not going to talk about here. But anyway.
Okay.
Yep.
Are you going to use the Thich Nhat Hanh book as the basis for your class?
Yep, that's it. A little bit about that class, because nobody has signed up. And I might mention about 2 years ago, we actually I had a great class, about three of us. This wasn't a formal class, but we actually read the three pillars, and we met every Monday evening up at Dunn Brothers Zendo, which is disguised as a coffee house a couple blocks up here. In reality, it was a great time. We read certain chapters. Let me just say a little bit about that. And again, the first about third of this book is again, a real basic understanding of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, etc. Real basic. But then one thing I didn't mention was, except in the third watch of the Buddha, basically we have the independent kohorai or dependent kohorizing, the 12 links, etc. And what the Buddha understood in his third watch basically was, the links between cause and effect. I haven't mentioned the word karma at all, these big concepts, etc. And that's something we want to look at. And so there are things like the three poisons and things like this. But also in that course, we just wanted to talk a little bit about liturgy. That is some of the ceremonies that go on here, so that people feel comfortable with them, if you will. What's that?
Your class?
It's Saturday morning from about 11 to 12, something like that. Yep.
Guy, I have to ask you a question. I got a little confused during your talk because you started off with Not maybe start off. We use a lot of physiological concepts to talk about reality and how it actually varies from individual to species and so forth. And then you circle back to very concrete concepts such as right or appropriate mind, speech, action. And that creates a dilemma because if there's a built-in relativity of how reality can be construed or perceived, but then there are ultimate concepts that are right or appropriate. Does that mean that through increased awareness we are building another sensory organ that allows us to see the world as it is?
Well, that's eyes, and here we have a whole year-long course, seeing reality. And basically, if you when you read Buddhism, and that's a very good comment you're making, because it is one of these paradoxes, in my mind, at least in Buddhism, because they always talk about seeing reality as it is. They talk about Buddha nature, the fact that Buddha nature is the what's inside us, basically, that sees reality is what it is. And the idea is that we become encrusted. With these various thoughts about reality. And I always think about being encrusted, if you will. We have ideas about conventional success. You all look too young to me to have midlife crises, etc. You wonder, did I ever measure up to my mother's hopes? Or things like this. And so that's these ideas about conventional success. Things like this. And so there are all kinds of, there's ideas about impermanence and things like this. And so in Buddhism, we actually find this idea that there is a kind of original mind that all of us share. But actually, if you look into it as an anthropologist, we can only think in terms of concepts, through concepts. You think of what was your first, when were you first aware of the world around you, for example? And it's when we start using concepts, and really start talking and thinking. And so for me, there's some problem in there, about, I can't be like Bodhidharma. I can't be like Shakyamuni. I'm Guy Gibbon in modern West with all the concepts that comes with my language, etc. And so that's a problem. And this is something that Dalai Lama, for example, works with a lot. What does it mean to talk about original mind and seeing things as they are? And that's just kind of the rhetoric, basically, of Buddhism. That's true. And I just kind of, unless somebody has a better answer. So for me, it's always working at, rather than worrying about the nature of ultimate reality, I worry more about dismantling, and this is a word, dismantling, some of these, illusions I might have, about, and they can be very, very culture specific. I mean, I didn't probably answer your question. And one of the great things about Buddhism is... No, I don't think so. Yeah. No, it's good, and it's a good thought. Now, the other thing, the other answer you get in Buddhism is that that you have to have faith that it's possible to see, the one who sees, of course, is a Buddha, the one who sees clearly. You know what I mean? But that's my thought on it. It's one of the so I don't worry too much about seeing reality as it is, whatever, but I work more towards working with these misunderstandings and things like that. Yep.
It's interesting that you talked about another sensory organ or something. There was an NPR maybe a month or so ago, they were talking about studies that they've been doing with Buddhist monks. And that they expected their brain to be, because of the meditation, to be less, to have less going on. But it actually, and combines the scientific evidence that their brains were highly developed. I don't know, did anyone else
Yeah, there is a professor at the University of Wisconsin called Wilkerson, you know, who's been doing all of these things. And it's an interesting story because, you know, all the money he gets for his psychological research, you know, had to do with illness. You know what I mean? Non-normality. And so he was interested in happiness. And, you know, what's a happy brain look like? Or a calm brain? And who else to look at but a Buddhist monk? And so it's wonderful stories. There are all kinds of articles about him. And he started out by taking his mental apparatus, you know, he has a little contraption, and he'd go up to the mountains in India, trying to go into the caves and whipping it on these people. And that didn't quite work. So now he's been working with the Dalai Lama and some of his most advanced, you know, colleagues, etc., have been going to Wisconsin for these kind of studies. And it's really interesting. And so what you do is, what you do see is, these different kind of brain waves, etc., and all this kind of stuff. And it's very, so it's not, when you meditate, etc., it doesn't mean thoughts disappear. You know, it's not getting rid of thoughts. You know, your mind is a thought generator. You know, they just bubble up. I always say bubble up. You know what I mean? And so what you do in your meditation, basically, is to not become attached, basically, to those thoughts. You know what I mean? To recognize when the three poisons are there. And they're there. I mean, they're there. I mean, you can, you know, look at it. You look at these really advanced monks and you see all kinds of pollutants and problems, etc. So they're there. I remember years ago we had a person practicing here who went to Japan to a monastery and was going to really learn, and was shocked to find that a lot of these monks, after their meditation, inside their robes they had a little pocket where their cigarettes were. They'd take it out and light up and things like this. So remember that the world's a complex, difficult place, etc. And again, when I say taking stock and being aware, well, what's going to happen if you sit and meditate? You know what I mean? What's going to happen? You know what I mean? What's it mean to experience deep samadhi? A word I haven't used, but deep calmness, etc. You know what I mean? Okay, any other comments? Okay, well, thank you very much.